As far as the Trump administration is concerned, they're adding another 5,000 Border Patrol agents and another 10,000 ICE agents, and they consider DHS and security at the border to be our front line of defense. We are increasing the size of our force at the border with very little oversight and very little of reprimand structure. These two agents involved in this particular incident on video were never reprimanded. They were on the job the very next day, even though they themselves did not follow their own procedure. And there's a 16-year-old boy who died. They were never taken off the force.
We're going to do part two of this discussion and post it at democracynow.org, talking about the latest news around the Mexico border wall and Trump administration policy overall with ICE and border agents. Giancarlo Sfrey, thanks so much for joining us. Two-time Emmy Award-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker. That does it for our show. If you want to see the transcript, video, or audio podcast, or send it around in social media, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Caron, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Sunfest, August 4th through 6th at Mountaindale Sun Resort, one of the first nudist clubs in Oregon. Sunfest 2017 has a Roaring Twenties theme featuring camping, jazz, dancing, nude Olympics, and more. Again, that's Sunfest, the weekend of August 4th through the 6th at Mountaindale Sun Resort, 27100 Northwest Dairy Creek Road in North Plains, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of National Health Center Week Health Fair Thursday, August 17th at 10 a.m. at the Neighborhood Health Center in Hillsboro. Neighborhood Health Center is a community health center serving residents in Washington and Clackamas counties. The health fair is a collaborative effort to offer health care, education, and support for residents in need and showcase the value for community health centers and their partners. There will be blood pressure checks, glucose testing, dental screenings, as well as information about emergency preparedness, health care, and more. Again, that's the National Health Center Week Health Fair, Thursday, August 17th at 10 a.m. at the Neighborhood Health Center, 18650 Northwest Cornell Road in Hillsboro. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
That was I think her name's Joy Villa with her rousing anthem, Make America Great Again, to set the theme for today's Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. I've got in the studio Jason Wilson. Good morning, Jason.
Hi, Paul. Nice to be here.
Great to have you. Great to have you. And Jason, for those of you who haven't been reading his stuff, is a correspondent for the Guardian. Is that right? A correspondent, or are you just like a freelancer?
I'm a freelancer, but 95% of my stuff goes to the Guardian. Permalancer, is that what they call it?
Fair enough. So check out his stuff. He's been tracking the far right, at least since the Bundy takeover last year, and certainly been aware of it since before. And you're from Australia, is it fairly obvious from your accent?
Yes, I am. I've lived here in the United States since January 2013, and in Portland since December of that year. So almost ready to apply for citizenship if they're still giving those out.
Fair enough. And so that's the Australia piece is something we just talked about just before the show, and you have, you know, the parallels as settler colonial. European settler colonial nation states are many and obvious to those of us paying attention, and I'm sure that's something you're paying ever more attention to given the reporting you're doing. But talk a little bit about the parallels you see before we get into the topic of this program, young white guys dreaming of an American renaissance, which refers to the conference you just attended in Tennessee, which we'll talk about. But yeah, talk about some of these parallels you see between particularly the Pacific Northwest and Australia.
Yeah, I think between incidents like, I do a lot of work in the interior of the Pacific Northwest, and including the Bundy stuff, and, also recently doing stories in the wake of those terrible murders that happened here in Portland and looking into the history of white supremacy here in the Pacific Northwest. I think there really are some parallels, particularly between the Pacific Northwest and Australia, in the sense that both throughout the 19th century, you had in both places people trying to create these kind of white utopias, which excluded people of color altogether. So, the Oregon Territory was like that. You know, Oregon's laws, actually prevented black people moving here for a really long time. And, you know, there were anti-Chinese laws, that kind of thing. It was the same in Australia. Australia actually deported a bunch of people of color in 1901 at the moment of Federation. Australia's Labor Party was involved in trying to exclude colored labor. It's the parallels are really striking. And, I think there's a history there in the 19th century of a lot of cultural exchange and a lot of shared ideas about white nationalism and white supremacy that really strike me. It's I look around at a lot of stuff happening and it looks kind of familiar to me.
And, I was also thinking, especially given the extreme heat we are experiencing starting today, that also the whole rabid climate denialism seems to be very pronounced both in Australia and the United States. It's another interesting parallel.
Yeah, it's quite something. I come from the state of Queensland. I actually grew up in the tropics right by the Great Barrier Reef. And the extraordinary thing there, when I talk to people at home, is that the politics there are all around, keeping coal mines open and keeping this mining industry open, even as the Great Barrier Reef right next to people is getting bleached. There's a kind of similar level of paralysis and with some people denial there in Australia that's a little depressing at times, for sure.
So the denialism in many different respects. You said earlier that there's a book in something we were talking about. There's certainly many books in that denialism. We both attended most of these free speech rallies that Joey Gibson is putting on, and other. And you mentioned you'd been tracking the Bundy affair, which I also did. And one thing I did, the last one, which was a very strange event, where they sort of the Antifa and the alt-righters kind of chased each other around Waterfront Park for 2 or 3 hours with the police nowhere in sight. Mm-hmm. I spent the time actually talking to them, trying to I really want to know from them, from their own mouths, what they think. It's two themes really stood out. One is the past is the past. Mm-hmm. It's like everybody said that. Some version of, let's just get over it. It's like, you know, why do you keep bringing that? You know, it's like the past, you leave it in the past. And the other is, you know, a bright new tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
It's like those are like almost everybody talked to said some version of those two things, which gets back to this, you know, we have to, you know, basically deny the terrible basis upon which these nations were created, and somehow come up with an American Renaissance, which brings us to your talk about what was that last weekend?
It was in Tennessee at a place called Montgomery Bell State Park.
Was he a Confederate general?
Montgomery Bell? I don't know. Oh. You know, we should look that up. But he there was a picture of him at the park. He looked like he might have been a Confederate general for sure. He had the facial hair of a Confederate general. it's a state park. It's about 45 minutes to an hour, depending on the traffic, west of Nashville. Now, they hold it in the American Renaissance are a white nationalist group. They advocate a white ethnostate to be carved out of the United States. And they hold it in this state park because it's a state-run facility and they get First Amendment protection there. So whenever they have tried to hold it in private facilities, it tends to get shut down. The venue comes under a lot of pressure, but they're kind of protected. They have an annual conference and they have a bunch of speakers, and it's the most overt and atrocious, racist stuff that you've ever heard. It's kind of surprising to hear it in the 21st century. Surprising for me, anyway. So they're trying to give it a kind of respectability. I had to wear a jacket and tie. They had a dress code there, and everything's got this kind of air of civility. They try and give their racism a kind of scientific or pseudo-scientific gloss. You know, there's a lot of talk about IQ tables and brain size and, you know, the distance of cultures from the equator and all that kind of stuff.
I thought that stuff had been roundly debunked about like five decades ago.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was really debunked by the Second World War, by the way that the Second World War went. That's what kind of shut down that talk of scientific racism. But, you know, these guys are trying to revive it. They're trying to they call it race realism. So this idea that, there are divergent attributes among human people, and it's all down to race. Different kinds of people are basically demarcated by race, and that goes to behavior, it goes to IQ, you know, and there's a lot of talk about crime as well. There was a lot of talk about mass migration to the countries of Europe and how that was, you know, lowering the average IQ of the population. I mean, all of this kind of terrible, nonsensical kind of stuff, but stuff that really speaks to that burgeoning of different far-right groups that we're now seeing on what's often called the alt-right. So they're actually, troublingly to me, there are a lot of young people there, a lot of young men there. They did a press release yesterday, American Renaissance, saying that half the attendees were under 35. And I have to say that kind of matches with what I saw.
And that's, I think, seems to be pretty true with what we saw in Portland as well. Most of the people I talked to at that one at Waterfront were definitely, you know, under 35, let's say, and a lot of young folks, and they seem to be, covered the range of these, you know, again, that go into the moniker alt-right groups. There are the Proud Boys. There are some people who are talking about this white ethnostate. Maybe they were part of this American Renaissance. You know, I'm pretty new to this, so that American Renaissance group was formed by Jared Taylor in 1990. I linked to both the American Renaissance own website, so you can read about it in their own words, and also a piece about them on the Southern Poverty Law Center website, which tracks all these groups. And so, yeah, talk about, was Jared Taylor, obviously he was there.
Oh yeah, and I talked to him. I've talked to him before for previous stories over the telephone, but I talked to him in person at this event. Yeah, American Renaissance you know, really started, it's really primarily been a talking shop. It's not kind of, it's not in the past been the basis of a mass movement or anything like that. But it was started by a network of guys led by Taylor, who had really been excluded from mainstream conservatism because of the ways in which they wanted to talk overtly about race. So one of the leading lights was a guy who's dead now called Sam Francis, who was the kind of intellectual leader of this movement, I suppose. His career followed a really familiar trajectory for these guys. He was an editor at the Washington Times, a conservative newspaper. And then he was fired from that, actually, after he said a bunch of racist stuff at an American Renaissance conference. This was a collection of guys who were really, excluded by people like William F. Buckley from mainstream conservatism and wanted to talk in these frank terms about race and wanted to advocate, as they say, for white people, because they feel that white people are really the most oppressed group in American society, believe it or not. Yeah. So they've been going as a talking shop for some 27 years, and suddenly they find themselves with this influx of young men who, largely have been kind of turned on to this stuff online.
I was going to say, so have you gone on, checked out this whole 4chan phenomenon? Have you gone down that rabbit hole some?
Yeah, a little. I've tended to actually talk to people who have studied it in depth. But yeah, I mean, 4chan, chan culture is one of the places definitely where people are radicalized, where they're exposed to...
And for those who aren't familiar, just describe that briefly. I had somebody on who wrote an article about that, so maybe people check that out, but probably some people still don't know what that is.
Yeah, I think, well, anyone who's a hobbyist of any kind, anyone who has a kind of hobby or niche interest will probably be familiar with, online forums where users can post and, conversations happen. So, a kind of message board sort of situation. 4chan is an extremely anarchic kind of version of that, where all users are anonymous and where it has tended to, there's tended to be an emphasis on shocking material, on edgy material. And one of the places where I suppose far-right ideology online has been propagated pretty intensively has been on the 4chan politics board. It's called Poll. And in fact, the guy who owns 4chan tried to clean that up a little, and some of them went over to 8chan, which is even more, extreme, I suppose. And that is one of the places where this is kind of filtered out into the broader culture, I would say.
So I'm speaking with Jason Wilson, a Portland-based journalist whose stuff mainly appears in The Guardian online, where people can find it. His most recent article is "Young White Guys Are Hopping Mad, Confidence Grows at Far-Right Gathering." Subhead, Race Realism and Call for a White Ethnostate, among themes at the American Renaissance Conference in Tennessee, which was just this past weekend. And we'll be here until 9 o'clock, and your calls are welcome at 503-231-8187. I believe we already have one caller, Joe, if I'm not mistaken. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, I tuned in a little bit late, but if I heard right a little bit ago, I think you guys were talking about, or the person from Australia was talking about the some group of people that want to have their own white community. And just to poke a little bit of fun at them, many years ago when the song by Garth Brooks came out called "I've Got Friends in Low Places," the people at KFAT Radio down in Corvallis, which was almost as good as KBOO, but they were a commercial radio station, but they did country and western, but they did the fun kind of stuff like you hear on KBOO, like the swinging country show and stuff. But anyway, and the Noontime Jamboree. But anyway, they did a parody. I think they did it, or I'm not sure exactly who did it, but it was about the same time Rush Limbaugh was about a year old or so on the TV and doing his TV and radio show. But they had some guy who had a dead ringer for Rush Limbaugh's voice, and they changed the name of the song to, instead of "I've Got Friends in Low Places," "I Like Friends with White Faces." And it was just hilarious. And if you guys can find that somewhere on the internet, I'm not an internet person, so, but if you can find that somewhere, maybe look up KFAT Radio.
Okay.
KFAT. And get that song out. So whenever they have to talk about these people that want to have their own white communities, poke a little bit of good-natured fun at them and play that song, because it's just a riot.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
I'll let you guys catch the next caller. Take care. Thanks.
Okay,
bye.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And again, it's 503-231-8187. So, you know, yeah, poke fun, but you also had a article, another article recently, we must draw attention to the far right. Not to do so is a dangerous concession. So there's many ways to draw attention to them. I think certainly poking fun, but it's also a deadly serious game they're playing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is always the prospect of violence in parts of this movement, and we've seen that over the last year. We've seen kind of a series of provocations which have resulted in violence. I mean, the real concern for me, I suppose, is again the thing I emphasized in the most recent article. There are a lot of young men who are at the beginning of their political development who are straight away coming into this quite extreme point of view. And the concern for me is what happens 10, 15, 20 years down the line? You know, when you've got these people who are starting in such a radical place, I mean, what does that do to conservative politics? You know, what kind of resistance is the mainstream right now mounting to this kind of stuff? I don't see, you know, there's such political fragmentation in the country today that I don't see a really bright dividing line between some of the folks who are associated with the current administration and some of the people in these movements.
You know, I just had this thought, you know, that there's this whole, you know, distress amongst farther left people at the inability of the Democratic Party to sort of wake up to the, you know, Bernie Sanders obviously sort of encapsulated this feeling of a more populist, more socialist, more radical vision that seems to be animating a lot of younger people. And there's a strong resistance by the institutional Democratic Party to kind of going with that energy. I see them personally as sort of moribund and needing to be energized and have some sort of renaissance. Yeah. On the other hand, you have this sort of perhaps similarly moribund institutional Republican, you know, this is like grossly oversimplified, yet they're sort of in sort of like giving way, you know, they're like sort of accepting this energy, you know, whether it's represented by someone who's seen as energetic, but is to me moribund, Trump himself. But as you say, there's all these younger people, you know, first it was the Tea Party, now it's this. It seems like there's a... I'm not sure what's going on there, but there definitely seems to be a I don't know if it's a what the psychological or political reasons are why the right is sort of giving way to these elements and the left is not giving way to their own sort of younger, more radical forces.
Yeah, I think for me there's probably a couple of main things I mentioned. I mean, these things are complex and there's a big discussion to be had about it all. But there's two things I'd point to. I think that conservative media is a pretty radicalizing thing. Conservative media now tends to be really critical of the institutional Republican Party, really critical of establishment Republicans, to the extent that you know, the tail maybe is wagging the dog, and you know, there aren't any powerful moderating forces in conservative media at all. The second thing is, I suppose, if you want to look at the Republicans and Democrats together and the political system as a whole, I mean, there are multiple crises, ongoing crises. You know, an economic crisis that the country's never really fully recovered from, and you know, the jobs that have been added since that crisis are not always great jobs. You've got a generation that's kind of in danger of being left behind economically. There's an environmental crisis, and you know, the political system, both mainstream parties have struggled to respond to that, and so people are tempted by, on the right, they're tempted by these more radical voices who are offering this kind of account of society that portrays young white men as the biggest victims in all of this. So until the mainstream political system can offer a kind of credible response to some of these problems, I think we're going to see people attracted to these radical solutions.
Well, again, your article, Young White Guys are Hopping Mad, I'd like to get more of your impressions, both from that American Renaissance gathering and the people you talked to, and your overall impressions, and your impressions having covered these so-called free speech rallies, and the one coming up this Sunday, again, organized by Joey Gibson, to which there'll be another counter-protest, and we can talk about all that. It's about 8:25 here. Before we go to Karen, hold on just a second, our next caller. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, The Politics of Living, hears from singer Rachel Taylor Brown, comic Sharon Lacey, and reveals the women behind the birth control pill and the board game Monopoly. At 10, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. Right after that, at 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Bike Show helps you plan your summertime bike adventures and see more of the world on two wheels, if you are able and so inclined in that direction. KBOO keeps you informed and involved, and we do need your continuing support and help. Go to kboo.fm and click on donate if you want to help us financially to become a member if you are not already. My name's Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. And we've got someone who's been, if not like those people who, you know, have infiltrated the far right. I don't know, so like about a couple decades ago, there's a guy who, I think, was in Idaho, and that's risky. I mean, it's, you know, it's a little gutsy to go to these gatherings, because just what you have to subject yourself to, if nothing else. But it's good. I mean, it's important. You know, I felt it was important for me to talk to them a few weeks ago there on Waterfront Park, and actually, you know, get a sense for them as, you know, they're human beings. They're not, you know, they're not cartoons. They're not, they may be sort of caricaturish, but, you know, they have their own life histories. They have reasons why they are attracted to this stuff. It's important to know about it. So it's good that you're doing that. But let's go to Karen and see what she has to comment on or ask you. Go ahead.
Hi, Paul. Thank you for being you. Always really enjoy your show, and think you have you make a great contribution to us. What I wanted to comment on was a good-hearted, I believe he was a good-hearted caller, called in and suggested some what he called you know, humorous approach to alt-right people. And immediately I thought, oh my goodness, that's scary to me, because many of these folks, maybe I don't know them well enough, but maybe all of them are dead serious about their racism, and they would not take kindly, I wouldn't think, and to lighthearted teasing. And I think of Jeremy Christian, who's willing to kill people. And I also went to one of the alt-right speakouts downtown. It was after the killings on the Max Line, or the murders on the Max Line. And I would recommend a very cautious approach to people who I think are neo-Nazis, or at least some of them are. They're scapegoating Black people, people of color. They've been taught to do that for really complicated economic reasons. As Paul, as you've pointed out, we don't know what their backgrounds are, complicated psychological and family histories. Anyway, that was what I wanted to say. I wanted to say, be careful, and thank you very much.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think we could probably do both. I mean, we But yeah, it is best to approach these folks carefully. But I think, as Paul said, they're also human beings. We can talk to them. We can ask them what it is they want and what it is that they think that they're achieving and what their goals are and where they're coming from. Because, yeah, they're people. We've got to share this city and this country with them. And I think that's what my instinct is in reporting. Like Paul, it's to go in there and say, hey, you know, why are you doing this? What's going on? What brought you to this point? So yeah, we can mix it up. There's no harm in having a laugh about the situation now and again, but overall it's a serious situation and it's a serious time.
Yeah, my feeling is I hate to use these overgeneralizations, but in my experience talking to some of the people there, there does seem to be this sort of thin-skinnedness, you know, this, which is kind of the sense that people have, that there's this kind of reactive, you know, white frailty, white fragility, male fragility, white fragility. You do get the sense, of course, Tiny the Samoan was obviously not white, but he seemed to be very defensive when I brought up certain subjects with him, which was a little scary. But yeah, I mean, once you get past that real reactiveness that they're kind of like always on, you know, they think that everybody's out to get them. You know, actually, I got into some really, you know, to a certain extent, in-depth conversations. I felt like they weren't really willing to go as deep as I wanted to go in really looking at actual history and the culture that we live in, because I do believe there is a denialism, you know, the denialism that, you know, white supremacy and, you know, and U.S. imperialism and all the rest is based upon, you know, a denial of our own vulnerability, a denial of our own history, all that. So before going to Michael, to talk a little bit more about what you saw there at the American Renaissance, things that kind of jumped out at you about what that, you know, you mentioned that there's a real difference between the Pacific Northwest and the South. There's real sort of echoes of the, you know, the South Shore, you know, neo-Confederate sort of thing. That seems to be a distinguished thing. Talk a little bit more about the scene there.
Yeah, I really do think there is, you know, it is important to mark out a difference between the kind of stuff that's happening here in Portland and even the militia movement, you know, which we can argue about whether that's implicitly white nationalist or, you know, I think it is, but there's a difference with this stuff in the South, which is openly white nationalist, openly talking about you know, an ethno-state, openly talking about, you know, setting aside a part of the country and effectively breaking up the United States so that there's a separate white ethnic homeland. I mean, that kind of vision of race and that kind of vision of community relations in this country is kind of uncompromisingly radical in a way that I haven't encountered here. I mean, maybe back in the 80s when you had you know, the Aryan Brotherhood in Hayden Lake in Idaho, you know, and you had those kind of more separatist movements up here, and I'm sure some of those guys are still around, don't get me wrong, and there are neo-Nazis, you know, scattered throughout some of these events.
Maybe they have to be sort of more camouflaged here.
Could be. But either way, I mean, they're not talking openly in the way that these guys are. And, you know, it's quite dark to me. That was the impression I had, to just go in there and listen to this kind of vision of the world, which seems to me to be really paranoid and really dark and really, you know, antagonistic, just on the basis of race. I felt bad in one sense for the people who are trapped in this kind of worldview, who are trapped into this view of race and the possibility of relating to their fellow human beings. So it was good for me to get outside and actually talk to the people protesting it, the event, who had a much more, obviously more generous view of the world. But yeah, that was the thing that struck me. To be in there, it was just a really dark vision of the world, and you know, to walk out of the conference, I felt like a weight had been lifted from me, really. And I wondered about the people who are locked into this worldview. I mean, you know, it must be a pretty stressful and depressing kind of place to be.
Something that just jumped out. I was kind of looking through this article again that you just wrote for The Guardian. Jared Taylor, you quote here, said such men, these angry young guys, were flooding to his group because they were, quote, hopping mad. These young white guys, he told The Guardian, they have been told from infancy that they are the villains of history. And I think that the left has completely overplayed its hand. There's a lot in that statement. Again, getting back to this,
right,
you know, the idea that I keep repeating that yes, in a sense, you know, we, you know, I'm perfectly willing to accept the premise that, you know, white patriarchal Europeans are in some sense the villains of history. I don't really have a problem with it. I think what we have to do is correct that to the extent that we are able. Whereas other people obviously feel, I don't want to get into a game like I'm more enlightened or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, in some sense, somebody is right and somebody is wrong in this, which is very difficult for people to come to grips with. But yeah, I mean, that says a lot that they feel they can't deal with the guilt, I guess, or they can't deal with, I don't know. There's a psychological explanation for it.
You see this a lot. I mean, going back to the comparisons with Australia, you see this a lot on the right there as well. There's just, you know, your word denialism that you keep coming up with. I mean, being confronted with the truth about American history or Australian history, for that matter, is just something that seems to back some people into such a corner, you know, that there's such a cognitive dissonance that they just can't kind of deal with it. So they retreat to this sort of worldview, which, you know, is extremely hierarchical and maintains the current hierarchies that are in place and really rejects these kinds of challenges and sees them as a personal kind of affront and as a personal accusation rather than a discussion of history. But yeah, I mean, another thing that Taylor said was, you know, that Black Lives Matter was something that had been a recruiting tool for them, basically. You know, he was kind of gloating about it, that Black Lives Matter had pushed a lot of young men into the movement. And again, you've got to wonder, I mean, you know, someone's telling you that police violence is disproportionately falling on Black people, and your reaction to that is what, to join a kind of openly racist movement. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to get into that game of saying that I'm more enlightened than anyone else either, but that's a strange reaction to the truth, I suppose.
Well, let's go to our next caller. Michael, you're on the air.
Good morning. So I'm relatively old. I'm 70. And starting in the 1970s, I saw the left begin to encourage tribalism among all kinds of groups, like among Blacks.
Tribalism?
Yeah, tribalism, in that we're part of a group and we're like proud to be part of that group, and we're maybe, you know, in some implicit way better than this other group, and, you know, we look down on white males and we're allowed to say negative things about them. Anyways, I've seen the left encouraging tribalism among these groups for decades now. And finally, especially in 2016, it looks to me like white tribalism is rising up, because if you're encouraging tribalism, then it's going to be encouraged everywhere. And I never thought encouraging tribalism was a good idea. I always tried to work against it. But, you know, I'm just one guy, and tribalism kind of took over, and now it has names like intersectionality. And so now you got white tribalism also. And, you know, I know who to blame for it.
I mean, I would want to kind of push back. I've heard this argument before that somehow the engagement on the left with identity politics has kind of in a backhanded way created a white identity politics. But I'd look at the history of the far right and say that, you know, they're always looking for scapegoats. You know, really, I'd rather think about the ways in which our political system has failed to deal with a couple of crises, you know, really big crises. And the far right has picked Black Lives Matter, has picked other protest groups as a kind of scapegoat. I think that's the dynamic that's at work here rather than anything that the left has necessarily done. The left is still pretty small and pretty powerless. I mean, when you look at the points of contact between what these guys are saying and what you hear in conservative media, I wouldn't want to blame people who have been scapegoated by conservative media for that either. I mean, I think we're getting into dangerous territory when we're blaming people who are being scapegoated by these movements for the fact that they've been scapegoated. Does that make sense?
Well, it's not. It makes sense, but it's not really exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying that, like, when you make all these derogatory statements about white people and
who's making what derogatory statements? Who's making white derogatory statements about white people?
You did a little while ago.
What do you mean? What did I say?
Well, I'll tell you. When people on the left behave in ways that white people feel are abusive by saying derogatory things about white people.
No, but you're not. What derogatory thing did I say about white people? What are you talking about?
Oh, we're to blame for all this.
I was talking about settler, European settler colonialism, which established itself here in America and Australia and led to the genocide of the indigenous people, large scale genocide, not the complete genocide, because thankfully there's many indigenous people still around, and that brought massive enslavement slave system, which is still completely unresolved. There's still this unresolved issue in the United States history of which has led to the incarceral state. That's the latest solution that the settler colonial establishment has tried to deal with the large-scale African population, which it itself imported here to the United States. These massive unresolved problems that were created by European colonialists. That's what I'm not talking about white people. I'm talking about settler colonialism.
Well, when you tell a story about white people, the meaning includes all the negative stuff and none of the positive stuff. That feels derogatory to some of us.
Well,
and then
they,
when we go to defend ourselves against that, then you come up with an ironic white fragility to describe it. I don't think it's fragility. I think we're defending ourselves validly from an attack that's unjustified.
I
and I'm not a member of any kind of white supremacist movement or anything. I'm just a guy that's been watching this stuff for decades, and I'm really irritated by it.
But it sounds, with great respect, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that if someone gives an honest account of the history of the United States and points to the present of say mass incarceration that Paul brought up, It sounds like you're saying that it's justifiable for white people to be personally offended by hearing that history or by facing up to those problems. And go ahead.
I don't object to facing up to those problems. I object to a narrative that goes, and those problems are the whole story about white people. That's what I object to.
Well, no, that's not
white
what I was
have
saying.
Also done tremendously good things in history. You know, I mean,
But you stacked up against if we had stayed in Europe and continued whatever those good things were in Europe. I mean, you know, the feudal system and the establishment of capitalism, I don't particularly consider very good developments. I think personally, I see the bad history that has been created massively overwhelming the good. That's my opinion. We could have a 5-hour long debate about that if you want. But you know, the point I'm making, the white fragility point, is goes back to what Jason was just saying. It's the feeling on the part of taking these things personally these things that are historical and not personal. It's the, that's what the white fragility is. It's the fact that it's white people who tend to be the ones who do that. Maybe that's why it's called white fragility. Anyway, we've talked enough about that. I do thank you for calling and engaging with us. I really appreciate it. We've got another caller, though, Jane, if you're hopefully still waiting on the line.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I wish I could talk endlessly because I'm familiar with the Firestone place in Tennessee. And you should look that up, Bill Haggerty, the history of Firestone and the black labor movement, if you're going to write about segregation. That's an interesting topic. And it also touches upon Japan. And, you know, I actually called in about, I actually was curious what you your thoughts on the Aryan Nation in the prison system in Portland, because Jeremy Christian was in prison, and they tend to recruit from there. And we have such a, Portland is unique in that it was so white that we have a pretty white criminal class that gets treated very different from the rest of Portland. We have a very different history of hatred of blue-collar workers. And then, of course, like, I'm Native American, and, you know, I've seen everyone's bad behavior over my lifetime, and I have tons of stories of Native Americans, and everything that would make Native Americans cry, they wouldn't want me to talk. Okay. I'll tell you this, though. We had one-drop rules in the Cherokee Nation because they killed your parents and literally took you to an Indian boarding school, shaved your head, beat Jesus into you, gave you a Christian name, and made you white. That is why when a Cherokee man sued in a federal court, and he was kind of a white guy, he was trying to get tribal status for his daughter and not have her adopted by non-Native Americans.
Well, can we get Jason to respond to the Aryan? You asked one particular question, the Aryan nations in the prisons, and Jeremy Christian. Maybe we could get him.
Okay, I just wanted to say, though, I mean, it is complicated, and yes, like, I'm a Bono from U2 fan. Bono from U2, explain that to someone who's from Africa, please, because...
Okay, you're going far afield here. Let's try to focus.
A little bit of a point.
Okay, thank you very much for calling. The issue, you know, I personally, I'll let you respond to this, but the whole Jeremy Christian issue is just it's such a terrible thing. Just such a terrible, tragic incident that happened, and the whole way that it's been talked about is a really difficult thing. And I think not enough attention has been paid to that. What Jane brought up was the fact that it seems like, I mean, I did read accounts where, you know, people gave a very different account of a very different Jeremy Christian when he was a younger person. And that's the tragic thing about whether it's going on to 4chan or 8chan or going to an American Renaissance conference or going to prison and meeting white supremacists there. People, you know, don't grow up, do not come out of the womb, you know, a radical white supremacist. That, you know, they become them through enculturation. And there's various ways to that. And it does seem like Jeremy Christian did go that route through his 6 or 7 or 8 year stint in prison. I don't know if that's something you want to address.
I mean, I think I don't know what happened to him in prison, if anything. And, you know, we'll find out more about that, I suppose, throughout his trial. And, you know, we probably have to be kind of careful in the way that we talk about that, because it's still gonna before the courts. But yeah, it does seem like his attachment to certain concepts, certain themes that a white supremacist became much more marked in the months leading up to what he's accused of doing, and that's evident on his Facebook page. I mean, the thing I would say about him is that it seemed to happen quite quickly. You know, his politics were really a mixed bag. There was a lot of misogyny in there for a really long time. And then suddenly, over just a few months, it seemed like he became much more engaged with white supremacist concepts, and I think that can happen quite quickly online, depending on, you know, who you come into contact with and depending on what you see in the culture around you. And it seems like he went to a rally looking for people who he thought shared his worldview.
That was the 82nd Avenue one, yeah.
Right. And, you know, whether or not he found it there, it was in the middle of a kind of process that he was going through that was really quite sudden and really quite troubling. So we'll see what happens at his trial. We'll find out more then.
You're probably right. We should be careful how we talk about this since it is going through the court. So let's go to our next caller, Mike.
Morning. Yeah, there's lots to talk about from my personal experience, but I'm more interested in educating people. So could you share some real information on websites and organizations like Southern Poverty Law Center or the authorities or FBI that we can send our cell phone pictures to all the pictures that we should be taking of trucks and license plates with clear white racist logos and behavior and celebrating terrorist white racism and Nazism, and it's all over Clark County because KKK, it's a center for KKK because they saw an opportunity for white Northwest up here, less Portland but more KKK up here in Clark County, and lots of organizations and young folks and lots of big crap kicker trucks, and they're sporting big flags and attitude and intimidating people. I call it terrorism because it's all about threats and so forth. So please give five or six places to send our pictures, maybe flash drive or electronically, and just to give everyone, authorities and such, a heads up on who these people are and what they're about. Thank you.
Did you want me to?
Yeah, I don't have anything. I know Southern Poverty Law Center is one. I know Rose City Antifa has been outing people, and so they're you know, I'm not sure. Rose City Antifa, A-N-T-I-F-A, was one place. I'm not sure about other.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I'd say to that caller, I'm not sure exactly what he's doing, but I would be careful, I think, in the way that I would approach, you know, freelance investigations of this stuff, and in the way I'd approach people who, you know, could be dangerous. I mean, if you've got information about
or not. I mean, you could also mistake things too. I mean, he mentioned big trucks. I mean, you know, these are like the tropes we're discussing. Yeah. I mean, we got to be really careful exactly identifying more specifically.
I think so. I think if you've got evidence of a crime that's been committed, you know, you can obviously go to the police. I think that if you want to check what you've seen against you know, broader trends, or you want to make sure that what you've seen is what you've seen, you could go to the Southern Poverty Law Center. Political Research Associates is another group. I think that there's a group called the Rural Organizing Project here in Oregon that is dedicated to organizing against far-right movements in parts of rural Oregon that people could check out and talk to. But yeah, I don't know if there's a central clearinghouse for pictures of people, and I wouldn't be going and putting that stuff online myself, people's number plates and all that kind of stuff, because even we reporters, you know, you've got to be sure about what you've seen, don't you? You've got to be pretty careful, I suppose, about depicting people as being part of far-right movements when they may or may not be. But I agree with what I think it's important what the caller is saying, that a lot of this stuff is on the rise, and it's on the rise in the Pacific Northwest, and it's on the rise in areas close to Portland and in Portland. And it's something that people in the community can talk about and make one another aware of. And certainly talking to those organizations, I think the Rural Organizing Project is a good one. Talking to those kind of organizations, making them aware of it and getting information from them about what might be happening is a good step.
Before we go to our next caller, Quartz, I believe was the name, Joey Gibson is having, I think, the fourth in a series of these so-called free speech rallies this Sunday, right?
I think it's more than that. He might be up to 8 now. I mean, this year. One was in Vancouver, but I think all the rest have been in Portland. I'd have to check that number, but I think it might be number 8. They've been going since January. So, yeah, but it's the fourth since...
From 82nd Avenue,
yeah. So that's, they're having that, they're going ahead with that this Sunday. That's right. And, you know, again, they're a really different group to American Renaissance. Yeah, there is a counter protest.
Called the Rally for Freedom, Solidarity, and Justice, Sunday at 1:30 p.m. at the Battleship Oregon Memorial Marine Park there, right on Waterfront Park in Southwest Portland, co-sponsored by quite a few groups, too numerous to mention. So that's this Sunday, if you want to join in. Let me just, since I'm mentioning upcoming events, this is something I meant to get to. Tonight at the Clinton Street Theater, Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock, at 7 p.m. Clinton Street is, of course, at Southeast 26th and Clinton. The newly released film telling the story of the No DAPL Native-led resistance against the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock, is a feature-length documentary directed by Academy Award-nominated filmmaker and activist Josh Fox. So again, that's tonight at the Clinton Street Theater, 7 p.m., worth checking out. We only have a few minutes left. I'm always torn between, I know I want to get the callers in, but I also want to talk a little bit more about Joey Gibson. Let's just go to our next caller, Quartz, I believe, if that was the correct name. Go ahead, you're on there. I guess not anymore.
I think it's me again. I just wanted to do a quick follow-up. Yeah, thank you so much
for your
understanding and concern about being careful. That's really, really true. You know, I have loved ones, and they'd be concerned if I got my nose in too far, but... there's lots of folks that have security clearances that can look up license plates and identities very simply and quickly without paying money. Can this stuff be sent to the police and so forth? Because this is terroristic sort of intimidating activity. And here's a specific example. Red truck, medium size actually. White guy, very uncomfortable young lady in the seat. White symbols, you know, the archaic thin white and black on white on black, and American flag. That's what pissed me off too. They don't even need to use a Confederate flag anymore. They just run around like they're patriots. It's disgusting. And I wondered, okay, why am I today? Because I drive around the county for my work. Why today am I seeing? This was like June 21st or something. Why am I seeing all these patriot racists? Guys running around in their trucks today with their flags up. It didn't make sense to me. Then later on, like a few weeks later, I looked online on the date. That was the anniversary of the Oklahoma bombing. Okay, this is where these people's heads are at. So just making it clear. Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you for calling. I would just say if you do see white, openly white supremacist symbols in proximity to a license plate, I mean, I don't see any problem, you know, if you feel that it's okay to put that, you know. I mean, I think people should be outed personally. How to do that anonymously and you know, staying safe. Jason Wilson, our guest's point about, you know, an active crime, I mean, or active intimidation, you know, actual intimidating behavior, documenting that, of course, that's important. If you want to take it to the police, if there is something you think they need to be, do it. If you feel, you know, you have faith in the police.
Safety first, though. That's all.
Yeah.
That's all I'd say.
Okay, so Joey Gibson. Do you know about Joey Gibson?
Yeah, so I've talked to him a few times as well, and his group. He's been organizing stuff here in Portland, as we said earlier, for most of the year, and you know, the biggest deal this year has been that rally on June the 4th, just a week or so after Jeremy Christian's alleged murders on the train, on the MAX train. So, Yeah, I mean, those guys seem to have this idea that they're pushing back against political correctness and standing in favor of free speech, and that's a really common thing, a common sentiment, not just on the far right, but you know, you'll hear it in conservative media. A lot of their talking points are really similar, actually, to what you hear on mainstream, you know, talk radio. But the difference is obviously that they're taking it to the streets and they're staging these kind of incursions into what they see as liberal bastions, like downtown Portland. Like I covered when they went to Evergreen State College as well. They you know, in the wake of a so-called free speech controversy up there. So that's kind of what they're all about. But a lot of these events that they run seem to devolve into, you know, scuffles and violence, as we both saw down there in Waterfront Park. Let's hope that doesn't happen again this time.
Well, we have to go. I wish we had gotten to talk about that particular subject a bit earlier, but that's the way it goes. But our guest, Jason Wilson with The Guardian, you can link. I have links to this one article, Young White Guys Are Hopping Mad, the basis for this particular discussion. But if you go to Jason Wilson, The Guardian, you can get links to all your reporting on all these things we've been talking about today. So thank you so much for coming.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
All right. This is Paul Roland, Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned for more excellent programming, including The Politics of Living, next here on KBOO Portland.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag Fuzzy Boo, and you'll be entered to win a chance to have Fuzzy Boo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/fuzzyboo.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032.